Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome everyone to the Really 007 podcast for this special episode focusing on a very exciting new Bond book, James Bond's DB5. Now, to celebrate the release of this fascinating, detailed, glossy and essential book, we are joined by Mr. Ben Robinson from the publishers Hero Collector Books. Good evening, Mr. Robinson.
Good evening.
Good evening. Now, there are various places you can find our podcast to listen in and follow, including YouTube, iTunes and Spotify, along with our website on the Pod Dojo Network. Thank you for sharing, rating and recommending our episodes. We can also be found on social media at Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Special shout out tonight to prominent Bond fan and good friend of mine, Mr. Phil Argyle. Thank you for your support, sir. So tonight we are joined by our good friend from Cinema Savvy, George Aldred, who is a massive fan of Bond cars, I know that, and the Aston Martin DB5 in particular. Good evening.
George. How are we?
Very well, and do you understand you have a miniature DB5?
Yes, I do. It's behind me on a shelf. I know this is audio, but I've had a bit of a redecorating, and I went to for the 50th anniversary. There was an incredible museum at Bewley, I think, before it moved to London, with all the cars and, you know, the Skyfall year, and I picked up a little DB5, and it's sat on that shelf ever since for 9 years, and yeah, it's what a beautiful car. Not that I could ever afford a real one. Maybe one day win a lottery, who knows.
Yeah. There are not enough of them about either for all of us, are there? There's very few. Yeah, so good to have you, George, here. But of course, we are delighted to introduce Ben, who has worked with Eon for 17 years, I believe, on various projects.
Yeah, and I think also, so.
Yeah. And you've also contributed to, well, you've written and edited, is it the 50 Greatest Bond Cars and an upcoming book called The James Bond Film Guide?
Yes, I can't take too much credit for the film guide. I'm the publisher, so that. But in my former life, I used to run a collection of Bond cars. I don't know if people remember that, like die-cast cars that came with the magazine. So yeah, I did that for 135 Bond cars. We did, yeah. So I've been around Bond and Bond cars in particular for a long time.
Absolutely wonderful. Yeah, it's an area we've not explored too much because I think the films we've reviewed so far certainly haven't really featured the DB5. I think only Skyfall is the one we've mentioned it quite a lot in. That was the big return of it, and we will go into that as we go along. Just to sort of get a bit of background into you, Ben, were you a Bond fan growing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think almost every man in this country, we always used to laugh about doing focus groups for Bond. It's like, go and find me some Bond fans. It's like, oh, well, let's just stop some people on the street. But yeah, no, I grew up with the films, and then obviously I was very, very lucky to get to start working with Eon. It was just before Casino Royale. I remember going to see that when it came out, with Eon. You know, we went to like the partner screening for it. Yeah, I was very excited to see the reboot from that. And then I've worked with them ever since then, actually. So I guess it was probably about a year before Casino came out that I started working with them.
So how do you get from that journey of being a Bond fan growing up, seeing the DB5 and other cars in Goldfinger, whatever, and, well, GoldenEye, of course, it came back in. But how do you go from that to being involved?
That's a very good question. I honestly don't know the answer. A lot of good luck, a lot of, happy accidents. I mean, I work on a lot of different licensed entertainment. So I've worked on, we do a lot of Star Trek stuff, Doctor Who, Transformers. God, the list goes on and on and on. And we were lucky enough that, Eon were happy enough with what we do to let us be part of the family.
It's absolutely wonderful. And the Hero Collector books, you've done so many already, and you've got a few more in the pipeline, that's right?
Yeah. I mean, Bond is, last year was our first Bond book. I mean, the idea was that the books would all come out more or less around the film, and then the film didn't come out when we were expecting it to. So we've been waiting patiently, like everybody else, to see it. So, yeah, so we did the 50 Greatest Bond Cars, which is a kind of complete selection of Bond cars. It's a family book, I would say. You know, it's not like the most detailed book about each car. We did that. That came out last November and still doing quite nicely for Christmas. Actually, I'm very pleased to see people still buying that. And then the DB5 book, because we had done this big build-up model of the DB5. So I knew that car, literally knew that car inside and out. And we'd always, wanted to do more with it. And we kept talking to Eon about it, and they wanted to do a book about the DB5. So when No Time to Die went into production, they said to us, well, if you want to do a book, this is the one we'd like you to do.
That's so good. So you must have known that it was going to feature prominently in No Time to Die then.
They did say, you might want to do the DB5. It's going to be one of the stars of the film. Yes. Gotcha. So, I mean, they obviously gave us their heads up about that.
So it must have been quite odd in this two-year wait, sort of waiting and waiting to release things. I know that's happened with a lot of tie-in things and journalists who've written articles and things like this. It's a very odd time, wasn't it?
It has been very strange. I mean, particularly, because obviously, without wanting to spoil the film,
there's, you can give spoilers, Ben,
prizes at the end. There are things that happen in this Bond film that don't happen in any other Bond film, for sure. And they actually, Eon was so sensitive about that they didn't even tell us about it. They were like, well, the DB5's, it's in the first 20 minutes of the film, and after that you don't have to worry about what happens. And then when we were doing the film guide, it was even more hush hush, because they were like, okay, well, you can put No Time to Die in there, but we can't tell you anything about what happens in it. You'll have to sort of, we had to sort of do it in a kind of secret loop where Will, who was writing the book, was like the only one who was allowed to know what happened. So I actually, I saw the film for the first time in the Albert Hall with all those assembled people.
One thing I really want to quickly mention, sorry to backpack, you mentioned the magazine. Was that the 100 issue build the DB5? Because I remember that as a kid. Obviously, kids don't get those kind of sets, but you hit an age when you're older, because I did the build the Millennium Falcon. And I've sat here ever since saying, are they going to re-release the build the DB5 one day? So I've got my fingers crossed. My wallet isn't, but I am.
It's available in America. I'm afraid that's not much comfort to you. It's a very tricky thing. Once you've made it, you have the whole thing about turning the tools on and then turning them off and all that kind of stuff. So we're currently available in America, not anywhere else in the world at the moment. So if you're prepared to relocate to the United States, then I can set you up with a subscription.
Will was going to come on, actually, originally. So the two authors are Will and Simon, aren't they?
Yeah, they just did my talk.
With Lauren. They're very busy men, but thank you for coming on, Ben. But do you sort of have the general idea for it, and then they're the ones who go in, and they've been visiting the sets, particularly of No Time to Die, haven't they?
Yeah, so, well, Will was the... So what happened was we had the conversation with Eon, and I sat down with my designer, Steve, who's the art director on this book, and we plotted the book. So I worked out what was going to be in the book. We had all the photography that we got from Eon, looked around to see what else was available. We'd done, you'll see there's like a lot of kind of little photo essays of the car sprinkled throughout the book, where you get to see it in loving detail, as they would always say.
Yeah.
That was a shoot that we had done when we were doing the build-up model, which we'd done using Eon's car. just after, I'm trying to think, was it after The World Is Not Enough, I think. But it was before, it's the pre-Casino Royale one, because we had all these kind of little continuity questions. We were like, oh, it's not the same as it is in Casino.
Yeah.
So, or maybe it was post-Casino. I can't remember. I can't remember. But anyway, that's Eon's car that we shot that was in there. So I plotted it out with Steve, worked out what the content was going to be, and then Will and Simon came in and wrote the actual content. Okay. And they kind of divided it up a bit between them. So Will came to us via Eon. So he was already on set at that point. He was already doing lots of stuff for them and had done it on the last couple of films. So that was great, because obviously we weren't in a position to sort of jump in a plane and fly to Matera to see the book. Yeah. So he was already there. So that helped. And then Simon did a lot of the, but it's a big book, obviously. So Simon was doing a lot of the research on the older stuff as well.
I mean, I've just got it here with me. It's almost as big as my body. This is absolutely massive. But it's going to be great under the Christmas tree, I think, for many people. But in terms of the actual structure of the book, it goes, obviously, the Aston Martin DB5. It does feature a little bit on some of the other Aston Martins, but at the end.
Mm.
But it's mainly on the DB5. And, of course, it's appeared straight from Goldfinger right through to No Time to Die. And obviously, there's been a lot of films which it hasn't been used for, and it had a big hiatus. But it's, like I said, this book is incredible. It's a must-have book, I think, for all Bond fans, and I was delighted to receive it. And it's also got a section on the replica toys and models, because so many people knew the car. I think I first knew the car through the toy rather than seeing Goldfinger, I think. So I think that's been incredible as well.
I think that's very true. When we did the big model, you know, I was always like, this is like the grown-up version of the Corgi toy that you had when you were a kid. You know, I mean, the big model has, you know, it does have, you can pull the Ogre Riders out and you can push the gear lever to make the ejector seat come out. You can pop up the bulletproof shield. It doesn't drop Caltrops out of the back, but it, you know, the light assembly at the back tilts down. So, you know, it could theoretically spray oil in your face. But it does.
There was one prototype was on this morning I saw, and they I think it was one which had been rebuilt and sort of built specifically by a designer. It wasn't one that was used in the films, but they are selling them, aren't they, to sort of people who want them. They have like fake machine guns.
Yeah, yes, if you've got £3 million.
Yeah, it was. They said that. I can't believe it.
Yeah, there's a chapter on that in the book. So yep. they're called the Continuation DB5s, and Aston Martin are making, they've made 25 of them for very special customers, obviously, well outside my reach. Yeah, they've made it as close as they possibly can. I mean, one of the stories you'll see in the book is that when Eon had finished with the DB5 in Goldfinger, they sent it back to Aston Martin, who fixed it. By which they mean, I mean, they stripped out all the gadgets and they put the roof back on. They, you know, no hole for an ejector seat in it. And they were all set to sell it again. And then it got called back into service. But yeah, nobody thought that it was going to be, you know, such a big deal.
I think as well with the DB5, it's the defining image. And when you look at all these franchises, you know, I'm just going to grab Star Wars at the top of my head. Defining image is something like a lightsaber. It's fictional. And yet with Bond, the fact it's a real car that was available at the time, and as mentioned in the book, the history going back to the Ian Fleming's works of previous models, we look at it sort of, you know, almost 60 years on now in this era of, you know, that defining image of Connery by the car. And I think what's been incredible for me, who's, you know, grown up, I'd say the Brosnan and the Craig era, that wasn't big on cars when they're younger, and I'm not massively on them, but when someone says Aston Martin, I think of Bond and everything that comes with it. I'm into my Formula One, so Aston Martin going in the sport was a big thing again, because it's the Bond connections. I think they named a car after Honey Rider as well, and I think it's been incredible to look back at it and seeing a book like this as well, where it gives people like a new viewpoint into it. It's just such a synonymous image with Bond, and as well with No Time Side, the timing of it, I know we'll get into it later, but it's like a beautiful way to bookmark it that we got to see it, not just as a road piece, we got to see an action sequence with it shot so well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, if you think about it, there's no other, certainly no other car that is as closely associated with a single character or franchise. I suppose there's the DeLorean in Back to the Future, I guess, but that, you know, there are only three of those films, and you know, lots of people buy DeLoreans and try to turn them into time machines, but that's even harder than adding machine gun to your DB5. Yeah. I mean, I think, and it's a kind of a metaphor for Bond himself, you know, that Bond and the DB5, when we were writing the introduction, it's like, you know, that they're both this kind of classic British, powerful, muscular, stylish, desirable, you know, thing. I guess Bond is a thing. DB5 certainly is. So they, you know, they do work really, really well together. And it's like a perfect blending of car and star, if you will. And of course, it only comes about as you in the third Bond film. You know, the first two Bond films, he basically doesn't really have a car. He's, you know, he has a hire car and a taxi in Dr. No. And then in From Rush With Love, it's all, you know, gondolas and trains.
I think it's amazing that, of course, it was in the book Goldfinger, which is 1959. So they had license to put it in there. But the car in the book is pretty different to what they created. I mean, Ken Adam, we go on about him so much on our podcast. He's an absolute genius. And then you've got the special effects supervisor, John Steers, and his team. But it's them who've sort of turned it, along with Aston Martin, that of course the designers, into this. The iconic is the word. We're saying it so often, but that is the only word you can use to describe it. It's incredible.
Yeah, and Ken Adam was instrumental in persuading them to get the DB5, because I'm trying to remember, I haven't read Goldfinger for years. There's a reference to Bond having an Aston Martin in... I forgot the name of the film, Moonraker. Not in the film Moonraker. In the book yeah. Moonraker is when Fleming's Bond has an Aston Martin. But it was really Ken Adam who had seen the DB5 at a trade show, an automotive show, and pushed to have it. And they had quite a sort of hard time persuading Aston Martin to lend them a car for a film, because Aston had had bad experiences with doing that in the past. And Bond was, you know, I mean, Bond was... you know, a thing by then for sure, but it was Goldfinger that turned it into this kind of incredible phenomenon.
I couldn't believe all the things that were sort of designed as it went along. You know, there were so many ideas people had. So Guy Hamilton, the director, he had the idea of the revolving number plates.
Because he got parking tickets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's absolutely incredible, isn't it? Mr. Bean would do, isn't it? And then you've got the spokes, which... You know, because Ben-Hur was popular, you know, just a few years earlier. There's so many things, isn't it? Is it Al Capone's car had the oil slick and the smoke screen? It's just incredible.
Oh, the other thing about it is that you'll see in the book, there are a couple of things in the car that never made it into the film. So it has a telephone in the driver's door, you know, like a regular telephone, not a mobile phone with a cable on it. And then he also has there's a drawer under the driver's seat that has a sniper rifle. So you actually see them, you know, you see Tilly's sniper rifle, but he has it in there, and it has a grenade and a sort of pistol that converts into a sniper rifle, but they never made it into the film.
Where's my Bentley?
Oh, it's head, it's day, I'm afraid.
But it's never let me down.
M's orders, 007. You'll be using this Aston Martin DB5 with modifications. Now, pay attention, please. Windscreen bulletproof. That's at the side and the rear windows. Revolving number plates, naturally. Valid all countries. Here's a nice little transmitting device called a Homer. You prime it by pressing that back like this. You see? The smaller model is now standard field issue, to be fitted into the heel of your shoe. Its larger brother is magnetic. Right. To be concealed in the car you're trailing while you keep out of sight. Reception on the dashboard here. Audio visual range 150 miles.
Ingenious and useful too. Allow a man to stop off for a quick one en route.
It has not been perfected out of years of patient research entirely for that purpose, 007. And incidentally, we'd appreciate its return, along with all your other equipment. Intact for once when you return from the field.
Oh, you'd be surprised the amount of wear and tear that goes on out there in the field. Anything else?
Well, I won't keep it for more than an hour or so if you give me your undivided attention. We've installed some rather interesting modifications. You see this arm here? Now open the top and inside are your defense mechanism controls. Smoke screen, oil slick, rear bulletproof screen, and left and right front wing machine guns. Now this one I'm particularly keen about. You see the gear lever here? Now if you take the top off, you'll find a little red button. Whatever you do, don't touch it.
No, why not?
Because you'll release this section of the roof and engage and fire the passenger ejector seat.
Ejector seat? You're joking.
I never joke about my work, 007.
There are some gadgets, of course, that we don't see, do we? We see the ejector seat, which is the one that everyone sort of remembers it most for, I think. And you've got the plant in the Q scene, you know, ejector seat, you're joking, which is another iconic line that everyone will remember. But the fact that we get to see it, because when it came back to GoldenEye, Q sort of told us about missiles, weren't there, and stuff. But I think it was either the budget or the production schedule meant you couldn't quite fit it into the film, which always left a bit of a sour taste in the mouth. I would have loved to have seen those being used by Bob.
Yeah, well, there's a time and a place for everything. I mean, there are a few, not a DB5, but there's in Diamond, there's a kind of a tiny scene of DBS in the background having this enormous rocket pack landed into the where the engine should go. You're sort of wondering, I wonder how it's going to drive with that. But there you go.
That is weird, isn't it? Yeah. Can you remember when was the first time you saw Goldfinger, George? I mean, it must have made a mark.
So, Goldfinger's a fascinating one. I always call it the ITV films. You know, when you're younger and they're just, you don't know the age you were, but you have definitive images from a film. Goldfinger, I always remember being when she turned into gold at the start, but it wasn't until I was probably, ironically, around the time Casino Royale came out. I didn't know it was a DB5 in Casino Royale. I was only 10 when that film came out. I loved the vantage from Dying of a Day. I know I defend that film a lot. But, you know, 6 years old, seeing a car flip with an ejector seat was an incredible experience. Oh. And I think as the years went by and I went to the older ones more, I think I was more attracted to just the look of the DB5, which I don't normally get with cars. I wasn't ever keen on the gadgets at a young age. It was actually always the design of it. And I think because I had a Bond car I loved that was essentially a gadget with the Vantage, it was really interesting as I got older and said more into my sort of F1 stuff, more into film, into Bond. I kept going back to Goldfinger more and more. And I think the car is such a defining reason of why I enjoy that film. And that's a really silly thing to say, but I think that's where I feel with it. That it's just so defining. And then obviously at my previous job, I worked at Pinewood. Walking down Goldfinger Avenue, sort of every day, going to the shop, knowing that that was where the famous car sequence was filmed, it's just grown on me as the years have gone by. And it's really fascinating one because it's by a country mile my favorite Bond car. And I just think it's interesting seeing the resurgence of it. I know we'll speak about the Craig era in a bit, but I think having it come up in more modern films has really helped, because without getting into that gap between Thunderball and GoldenEye, I've had this sort of thoughts that when you have these classic cars, there's a window between them coming classic. They can be iconic instantly, but we know that Roger Moore never had an Aston Martin, and it's a shame, and I know people speak about that, but he would have been so timely. It's sort of, you know, 7-8 years later, it doesn't make the car that modern, if that makes sense. It's not old enough to be deemed a classic car. And I think by not having him in that, giving him the Lotus, which is a wonderful car as well. When you get to Brosnan, I think the DB5 has become such an iconic image. You can afford to go back into the past and make it this classic car. And I think that's what I found really interesting with this legacy, that time passed and it's just improved it. And I think them taking it into story reasons in the more modern films, I think it's really evoked how important this car is to the franchise. And I think that's where I kind of stand with it, that everything to me, and not just with this, but the where Bond went on to become, Goldfinger is essential to all of it. And for him to get that car, I'm not saying the car's a part of that, but it is certainly the bigger picture of everything that ever came together for that franchise of that film. The DB5 is one of the important reasons for that.
And it's a British institution now, isn't it? The fact that it was a British car, I know Lotus as well, but when it culminated in Skyfall, when everyone was loving Britain a bit more than they do at the moment, perhaps, but it sort of all culminated, didn't it, with the Olympics opening ceremony, and the Adele song was massive, and then you reintroduce the DB5 and a return to sort of the classic Bond elements. I think it was done perfectly, and that's why you've now, like you say, George, it's become classic as opposed to just another Bond car that, that Sean Connery used and Pierce used a couple of times.
I was just going to say, but it was a phenomenon straight out of the gate. I
mean, yeah.
You guys are quite young.
We are.
But, you know, when Goldfinger comes out, that car, you know, the Corgi toy that comes out suddenly becomes the most successful toy in the world. Yeah. You know, everybody sees it and they go, oh, how great, how cool, I want one. And then that toy plays a major part in the car becoming such a big deal. I mean, you know, it's in Thunderball, obviously, because they want to bring it back. But it's not in Thunderball that much. I mean, it's a couple of scenes. And then it gets replaced. I mean, the most incredibly beautiful Toyota 2000 GT in You Only Live Twice. But then, you know, when Bond's back in Britain, he's in a DBS rather than in the DB5. So you're absolutely right. It's like it was no longer the latest car. You know, it was so new in Goldfinger that you couldn't actually get one. It's actually the car that they drove is the prototype. It's the very first DB5. But yeah, it instantly became an essential part of Bond, I think.
Because there's two, aren't there, to start with, and then there were two later. There's the prototype one with all the gadgets, and then there's the one that they used for the exterior shots.
Yeah, they took one. So what happened was they took the one for the exterior shots to Switzerland, which didn't have all the gadgets in. I mean, when you look at where Goldfinger was filmed, it's extraordinary. It's like, they did a little bit of filming in Florida. They did a little bit of filming in Switzerland, and the rest of it is filmed in, you know, just around London. So it's filmed at Pinewood or at Stoke Poges or, you know, all those places. So they had the road car that went out to Switzerland, to the Furka Pass. And then it actually developed a few little problems. So they had to bring out the stunt car. And if you're real geeky, you can spot the little differences between it, like the GB plate that appears and disappears on the back in different shots.
No, I love all that stuff. You are right. It then went on a world tour, didn't it? So, just think how popular that is to have to do that. And that necessitated the demand for it to be in Thunderball, didn't it? Which is only a year later. This is how quickly they filmed.
Well, I mean, they were making a Bond film every year then. And the other thing that's extraordinary about it is that because they literally had to make prints, so, you know, there were only so many celluloid reels going around the world showing a Bond film, it could take a year from it being originally released in one country to still being shown in another country when the next film was out. So, you know, by the time Thunderball had been released in the UK, there were places in America that were just getting to see Goldfinger for the first time.
It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
And that tour is an extraordinary thing because, I mean, again, you didn't have the sort of instant global media that we have today. So they had these cars, which were not exactly identical to the one in Goldfinger, you know, going around America, and they would get like driven into the middle of your town or city, and all these crowds would come to look at it, and they'd demonstrate all the gadgets. And, you know, it was just like a kind of circus coming to town. It was extraordinary.
And I think as well, with the sort of the marketing, jumping again to sort of today, if you look at No Time to Die, I'd argue genius marketing putting at the forefront, because it's the opening 20 minutes of the film. And that was a way for them to protect so much of what came later on in that film. It's a long film as well, which the fact they're able to cover so much of it. Even still, you sat there on the opening night and you watched that, and there were still set pieces with Aston Martin that you hadn't seen or wouldn't know. Or I think when you've seen a trailer so many dozens of times from being at the cinema or seeing online, and it was still an incredible action set piece to see it. And I think not only was it because of how good it was on film, but seeing how they've marketed it. There's been a conversation I've seen a lot of people have recently saying, you know, has the DB5 been around too much? Are they marketing it too much? And I kind of want to just ask both of you that in truth, that because I personally think it's so synonymous to the franchise that it's a marketing tool, but the use of it in the film isn't it's in it for 3 seconds and we've said it's going to be in it. This was a genuine, we're marketing it because it is a key point.
Because the Daniel Craig here is more, into, you know, it covers a smaller period of time. And essentially, you've got the first two, and I know it isn't in Quantum, really. But aside from the Skyfall which is set, I suppose, some years later. Spectre and No Time to Die are essentially when Materia is straight after, isn't it? So it's not like you're going back to the same thing every few years and sort of re-emphasising it. I think it was perfectly fine to do that, and it worked well in the film. And you're right, once you've had that amazing set piece, there's no need to sort of use it again, because you want to give audiences wanting more, specifically with the cars, because we get to see an awful lot of it this time. And I think, apart from Goldfinger, this is the most we've seen, isn't it?
Definitely.
In action. And it's like, yes, finally, we get to see a bit more of it doing what it does, and some gadgets, which in the Daniel Craig era haven't been as prevalent, particularly the cars, because in Casino Royale, it's bought as on the bet on the casino table. And of course, it's not used. It wouldn't be appropriate to use all those gadgets then.
All in. No way. 20,000.
Table stakes. I'm sorry, sir.
Okay. This is on the table. That's my car. Want to bet?
I'm sorry, Mr. Demetrius.
Please, no. Give him a chance to win his money back.
All right, show me, gentlemen. Three kings. Trip aces. Aces win.
Oh, and the valet ticket.
And it's sort of weaved into the story that I assume that in the background, Q has been working on it for him, and he's been demanding all these little things, which works as well. So, yeah.
It's also, it's very sort of symbolic of Bond and his story. You know, there's I think if you go back to Casino Royale, there's the music cue when he gets the DB5. It's like, this is when he starts to become Bond. Or seven, or however you want to look at it. And then, you know, when if you think in Skyfall, the car is destroyed, and effectively the same long sequence where M is killed, you know, and then it's all about restoration, you know, in Spectre, so that, you know, he gets the car and he goes off to this new life. But then when the car is destroyed at the beginning of No Time to Die, it's also the end of an old life. So his life as Bond is, his life as Bond is kind of over at that point, and it goes with the car and Madeline.
And I think it's a really fascinating point as well, because I know there's been discussions as to people think, you know, would Spectre have been the last Craig film? I think irregardless of people's thoughts on him, the image of Bond retiring, driving off into the sunset with an Aston Martin DB5 with that theme was an incredible ending to do. And then, you know, he does come back, and how do you carry on from that? And it's a really smart way to then bring it back into the forefront. And the sort of what I've seen online about this, the conversation with the D5, it's been really fascinating. And I think it's great that the car has had the spotlight again. And I think especially with the Craig era, because of how big that 50th anniversary was, I know it was almost 10 years ago now, but as you said earlier, Tom, with the British public at the time of the Olympics, everything was sort of precision for that film, that they did the right thing. Even the music cues to get the DB5 in, I think it was well earned. And because there wasn't that much of it with Brosnan's era, it felt like there was still a bit of a gap. Whereas, so we don't know what's going to happen next, but if the next Bond popped up on the opening scene with a DB5, it'd be like, ooh, is this a bit soon? Because we've just had it for so long with Craig. And I think it's such a fascinating discussion because of how integral it is to these films.
It is a really interesting thing of what makes Bond Bond. You know, what are the essential elements? Because Casino was very much an exercise in reducing the formula down to the point when, you know, it's still James Bond, but you've got rid of all those trappings. You know, he doesn't say Bond, James Bond until the very end of the film. And my God, that got a round of applause when I saw it. You know, he doesn't, you know, he in Casino, when he's, you know, he orders the vodka martini and the barman says shaken or stirred, and he says, I don't care. You know, so you can get rid of all these things, but there are also things that are just pleasing, you know, just so satisfying for all of us who grew up watching Bond with our dads. You know, I always think that's such a big thing. It's like, it's kind of an emotional touch point for so many men that, you know, this was our, you know, our thing, you know, and thousands and thousands of people's thing, but you know, those moments, like there's a bit in Skyfall when they're back in the old school kind of MI6 offices and it's got the padded door again, and I was amazingly moved by that, you know, just like, oh my god, it's back. I had forgotten about it. I didn't even realize I'd missed it. And I think that's the feeling you get every time you see the DB5. It's like, I hadn't realized how much I've missed it.
So 007, lots to be done. Are you ready to get back to work?
With pleasure, M. With pleasure.
Sooner or later, the new Bond will have to get a DB5.
Yeah. Yeah. You said going back to when you watch it with your dad. That's what Pierce Brosnan did, of course, wasn't it? And Goldfinger is his favourite Bond film. And that had a massive impact on him. And to sort of have that and back in... Well, what was it, 30 years, wasn't it, since it had been in Thunderball? It's a heck of a long time. So when it came back then, it was a big thing. I know the BMW, the Z3, was the sort of the main one they were selling for the film. But the Aston Martin, that was the one sort of people were talking about coming into it. And to have, again, two of them, I think. But it's fascinating, the history behind it, and the book does go into it, that some people think, oh, because it's got a slightly different number plate, the continuity is different, but... That was only because the other one wasn't available, because it had been sold, I believe. So.
And the number plate wasn't available. That was the thing that was really difficult. Yeah, they couldn't get the number plate. They did eventually get it sorted out. But yes, I mean, it's... I think, again, with Brosnan, you know, there was this desire to relaunch the franchise at the time, and you're trying to say, this is Bond. You know, this is 1990s Bond. And that continuity... You know, it is very different. And, you know, it does move the franchise forward, but it's still got those kind of touchstones. And the DB5 is one of the, became, from that point on, really becomes one of the biggest touchstones.
And I think as well, when you look at Brosnan with the BMWs, it's not a slate against BMW, but when he gets that Aston Martin back in, it's more about the brand, I guess, more than the DB5, but when he gets Dying of a Day, you want him to have an Aston Martin, because we've not really seen him in one since GoldenEye. And I think that's the testimony of that brand, of its importance to the franchise, that, you know, I know people are going to have their thoughts on the invisible car stuff. I don't mind it too much. I think, Tom, it was Lorenzo on the anniversary podcast that said, hey, people like a Lotus Esprit that can swim underwater. Why not have an invisible car? The logic works, but it's one of them where I just think that, you need it so much. And even again with the Craig ones, I loved the DBS. And again, maybe it's because 10 when Casino Royale came out, you got the spinning stuff. I remember the news articles for it breaking those records, and I think it's just such an incredible testimony to how the two work. And I think I've read before that the way the deal is constructed with them is that they, it's essentially free advertising for both, that I don't think they pay Aston Martin for showing the cars, vice versa. I'm not sure on the logistics behind it, but it's essentially post BMW. So the two almost agreeing that it's best for both of us to have these films on.
It's a very happy relationship now. I mean, I can tell you, you know, obviously we work with both Aston Martin and with Eon, and they, you know, they do work very closely together. And you know, it's just such a good fit for Bond. And as you say, it's become kind of synonymous. And I was particularly happy to see the DBS in No Time to Die as well.
That, I mean, we're obsessed with Timothy Dalton as Bond, and and that car, just him in the three-piece suit, and it's just so that brought back more great memories as well. But you mentioned the, of course, Aston Martin, and the book has a foreword from Marit Reichman, who's the chief creative officer, which I found quite interesting, and that's a nice touch point into the book, I think.
Yeah, one of the lovely things actually is that we weren't allowed, because obviously we finished the book in time for the original release date. So the only person who has had a copy of this book is Marek. Apparently has been on his coffee table in his office for the last 2 years. maybe not last 2 years, last year, certainly. The second time around, I think, is when we sent it to him.
But it does show there's a lovely working relationship between Eon and Aston Martin, which it's going to go on. Yeah. Of course it is. I think that'll continue. I know, well, there was a one in the background so briefly, No Time to Die, while I was on the phone, wasn't there? There's another new one, yeah, Valhalla.
I don't know if I'm going to quote this wrong, so apologies to someone, but I'm sure I read that the original goal was to have Bond drive it, but I believe it was the prototype model, because it's the first electric Aston Martin, and I believe they couldn't get it into London or something along those lines. And
I haven't talked to them in detail about how the script evolved, because obviously it was very hush-hush. So, but my understanding at the time was that it was something that Aston Martin were very keen to have in the film, and Ion were happy enough for it to appear, but they basically, this is the car sequence, was at the beginning, and they really wanted that to be the DB5. So you have had instances, I mean, you know, Nomi drives the DBS, the most modern Aston that you can actually buy as well. So, you know, obviously Aston Martin are supplying MI6 with a wide range of cars.
And you've got there's two more forewords, of course, in the book. There's Michael G. Wilson. Have you had much dealings with Michael?
I know you've been there. Michael occasionally kind of has wandered into the room. Ion have this most incredible meeting room, which looks like something that you have to be inspector. So like the scene in Thunderball where everyone's sitting at the massive table and you go in and it's like, you know, it's got enough for a whole production office in there. So I was having a meeting in there once when Michael walked in with David Putnam, just to show him the room.
Right.
Wow, so, I mean, I've met him a couple of times, but he doesn't really, he doesn't get too involved in the sort of the level of stuff that we're doing. He's not too involved, or Barbara for that matter. But yeah, but he was very gracious to give us an introduction as well. And then of course, Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel's got a forward, yeah.
Who wrote a beautiful forward for us.
Do you think it will be as associated with him as it is with Sean going forward now?
I think that's a good question about Bond. I mean, not just about DB5. I mean, I think everybody has their own kind of touch point for Bond as to when it was important to them. And I think it's sort of largely a function of age. I know a lot of people who are a little bit younger than me. I mean, I grew up with Roger Moore, but for me, I was always a Connery man. You know, it's that. And but then to me, Daniel Craig really rivals Connery. You know, that they are, to me, they're the two kind of really golden eras of Bond. But there's a lot to recommend, you know, all the Bonds at different points.
If you're enjoying Really 007, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram? Look us up at Really 007 Pod.
Every Bond has a defining car, which is really strange to say, but Connery is the DB5. Brosnan has the Vantage. I almost said Vanish then. I don't want to make the awful pun. Dalton, of course, has the V8. And I think Craig's has become the DB5. You know, you just go back to Skyfall with the posters they had. They did the photo shoot in Scotland as well. And I think it has become synonymous with him. And there's something about where, and it sounds quite bonkers to say, but the car just whatever reason, it just works for that Bond that I couldn't imagine. I don't know if this sounds, I mean, anyone could drive a DB5, but I just think there's something about Connery and Craig in that DB5. And I think Dalton could easily drive a DB5, but that V8 is just so perfect for him. It's a really interesting conversation with those like defining, I guess, cars with the actors.
They're definitely, I mean, Connery apparently found the DB5 quite an uncomfortable car. Because he is
a big guy, isn't
he? He's a very big guy. I mean, and You Only Live Twice, it's even worse than that. They actually had to cut the roof off the Toyota in order for him to get into it. And so that's why that's like the only convertible ever made of that car. It's true. That's a true story.
Yeah.
He was like this. He was kind of like Mr. Incredible, hunched over the wheel, and he looked terrible. So they cut the roof off. But, you know, the DB5 is, I mean, if you see them in real life, they're really quite small. You know, it's a very stripped down car. Whereas if you see that V8, it is just such a kind of, it's like one of the few sort of British muscle cars. It's like a great big throbbing car that is full of energy and strength. And I don't think, I mean, as well made as those films are, I think that doesn't quite come over as much in the films as it does when you actually see one in real life. And yeah, I mean, the Lotus is, you know, it's classic Roger Moore, isn't it? It's drop a fish out the window as you drive out of the cinema.
That's so Roger, isn't it? In a moment, if you could sort of epitomize what his Bond was, that is it, isn't it?
Yeah, don't worry if it doesn't quite make sense. It's very funny. Yeah. It's funny and it makes you smile.
Yeah,
you
know. There's huge leaks in the car then, so it wouldn't work. Yeah, but yeah, we love it. But yeah, so I mean, Thunderball. Going back to Thunderball, it wasn't in it too much because obviously the main star of the pre-title sequel pack is the rocket fuel pack, and it comes back down to earth with the DB5.
I think. I mean, they didn't. They were slightly caught out by the popularity of the DB5. You know, as I say, I don't think anyone had originally intended for it to be in Thunderball. But when they saw the response to it in Goldfinger, it was like, well, we've got to get the car back. We've got to get the car back. What else can it do? You know, and then it has, it does have a slightly amazing piece of logic where the amount of water it pumps out actually has to have a fire engine snapping by to get enough water there to pump it through, which you can see in the book.
It's a great photo of that. You can see the fire hose underneath the car.
Yeah, otherwise there's a lot of water in that car. It's like, you know, that's it's quite a small boot, quite a small trunk. But yes, I mean, it and of course, it, as we said, it went off on its world tour at that point. And, you know, Connery drove to the premiere in Paris in a DB5 and he's getting mobbed. And there are pictures of that in the book. It does become this kind of massive deal in the space of really 18 months. And then, you know, I think you're right. They did kind of worry that it's like, well, it's not, what do we do for that? What do we do to top this? Where do we go from here? You know, let's have a, I mean, You Only Live Twice obviously had a, it didn't make much sense that he would ship that out to Japan, but he has Little Nelly instead. You know, it's like that whole thing of like, how do we top Goldfinger, which is, I mean, you know, still a question that every filmmaker who's making an action movie probably should ask themselves. How can I do better than Goldfinger? I don't think many, if any, people have succeeded.
The DB5 is a big thing of that. The reason I think people love it so much is not only is it a beautiful car on its own, but you believe that it could do that. You believe that.
Well, it did. I mean, all of those things worked. I mean, okay, it wasn't real bullets in it, but you know, everything that it did for real.
Yeah.
And all of those gadgets really fit in the car. Yeah,
and it outshines the Rolls Royce as well from that film, which is not an achievement many cars could ever do, but that one does. And I think that just adds to the Goldfinger versus Bond rivalry.
Yeah, and it looks, I mean, Connery just looks so cool in that film as well. And that photograph of him leaning against the car is one of the most iconic photographs from a film, let alone a Bond film.
Yeah, I definitely need a poster of that up soon. But it's the Furka Pass one, isn't it?
Yeah,
and I know you can see it here, but of course Daniel Craig's got his own one in the Scottish Highlands as well, which is now, that's probably the most synonymous picture of him with the DB5, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the you see the pictures of him, I guess, but yeah, with it doing the donut, that picture's been there. Becoming a bit of a classic.
So normally for the films, they've had two, weren't there? There's like a prototype or possibly two.
I mean, there's a fantastic, one of my favourite pictures in the book is from Matera where they've got like nine.
Well, driving
around in like the question mark. Yeah.
So Cary Fukunaga was like, no, we're going to have a few more here. And it's such a tiny place, isn't it, to be doing all these stunts?
I mean, when you get the book, you have a chance to read it. You'll understand how.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How things have changed. You know, so when they shot, I mean, we were going through the Eon archives and trying to get everything they possibly could. And we were saying, well, are there any storyboards for the Goldfinger sequence? Did anyone storyboard it? And Meg, who's the archivist, she says, oh, I don't know. I've never seen anything. She contacted Peter Lamont. And he said, oh, no, we didn't have time to do storyboards. We just, you know, we just wrote it down, worked it out. But oh, that's fine. And now, you know, I mean, and there are storyboards in here. Even, you know, there are storyboards from GoldenEye. There are storyboards from No Time to Die, or from Skyfall, certainly, in here. And you realise how things change, and that, you know, there's that one shot again. It's in here. There's that one shot in Skyfall where the rocket hits it, and they built that quarter scale model just for that shot, just for that shot, and it's on screen for like less than a second.
And there was a scrap Porsche, wasn't there, for one of the...
When you see, like, the carcass, as it were. That's where that is.
I think the fact they can essentially kill off a car in a film and have such a reaction at the time, which it did. I remember watching one of my friends, and we both looked at each other, like, not the DB5, and then I think the fact that then Craig reacts to it and you get a big set piece from it, I think... It just adds to them knowing the knowledge firsthand that this is an iconic thing, and it was a very risky thing to blow up the DB5, and it worked. I think it worked.
Well, then but you can fix a DB5. You know, you can't fix a DB5.
Exactly.
But it also has. I was going to say this earlier. It has that incredible moment. So the thing is, we're all so familiar with the DB5. We all know what it means when it appears on screen, and then there's that moment when he's driving M up to Scotland and he just implies that he might eject her, and he doesn't have to say there's an ejector seat, he doesn't have to do anything, you just see him move his finger over the gear stick, and we all know what that means. And I don't think there's any other film franchise where that could be true.
And I suppose that's completely inconspicuous.
Get in.
Very comfortable, is it?
Are you going to complain the whole way?
Oh, go on then, eject me. See if I care. Where are we going?
Back in time. Somewhere we'll have the advantage.
That again, that got an amazing reaction at the cinema, and it's easy to see why, isn't it? What do you think about the continuity of the DB5? Do you think it's a bit like, you know, you can have a new actor, can't you, as a new Bond? And no one sort of really mentions that it's a new actor. The DB5 is like continued throughout the ages, hasn't it? And you don't really need to explain why, I suppose.
I mean, continuity in Bond is it's a tricky question. I mean, up until obviously when you get to Daniel Craig and it's like, it's a hard reboot. It's like, no, nothing that you ever saw before has happened to this Bond. You know, this is his day one. And I think that was a shrewd move, because up to that point, you know, that you have Roger Moore going and standing by Tracy's grave, you know, so there is the suggestion that this is the same Bond, but you know, he's aged remarkably well from from going out to Jamaica in 1962 to, you know, going to the ice in Die Another Day. You know, it just doesn't quite make sense for him to be the same person, but they never kind of formally like draw a line and go, okay, Pierce Brosnan's Bond never married Tracy. You know, that's a... I don't know. I think in my own head that's probably right. I mean, it's...
We don't really matter.
I don't think it really matters.
No, it doesn't matter.
But I think, you know, that to me, yeah, I guess for me, I imagine that sort of Dalton is a new character to Roger Moore, but the whole Roger Moore Connery thing, there is definite continuity. I mean, it's not something they bash you over the head with, but it does feel... I mean, Felix is a different person every time you see him, of course.
Yeah, Felix is the one. At least they have the same one for Daniel's films. But
yeah, and he came back. David Hedison came back in License to Kill.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, he suddenly it's the same person again. How did that happen? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Oh gosh, yeah. So the hiatus, we briefly mentioned that. Could you just tell us a bit more, Ben? What on earth was going on with the car?
What happened to the car? It ends up in front of a diner in Canada. It's bizarre. It gets bought, there are a couple of them, but the main one gets bought and is actually on display outside a diner in Canada. And people come and, you know, eat their burgers or whatever. And then the DB5 is in the front drive. I mean, it's an amazing thing. I mean, I think it's like you were saying, it stopped being the most modern car. It becomes this, like, so there's this big, big deal and it goes off on all the tour, and eventually the tour ends and everyone's like, well, that's that. We've moved on. You know, Bond has different kind of cars now. He has, you know, cars become a sort of a big deal in the Bond film. You're always looking to see what the car is going to be, and there isn't always one. But, you know, you're always looking when you go into a Bond film, you're waiting to see if Arkar does something. But the DB5, they just, you know, I think everyone thought it was part of history. You know, the various cars are sold off. You know, there's the long, complicated story of what happened to the main one. And, you know, even today, people are trying to sort of say they know where it is and all of that, and it having disappeared. I think in the 90s it disappeared. But yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. Now, I just think everybody would know where it was every minute. But at the time, it was like, yeah, we'd sell it to a diner in Canada. You know, it's like, how strange is that?
I think there's a story as well about the Aston Martin from Honor Majesty's. I can't remember the article I read, what the source was, but I think an Australian ended up buying it, and he didn't realize for years that it was that original screen-used one. And it's those incredible stories that I think it just shows, you know, the legacy of those films. And because in the 60s as well, they were massive, they were big, of course, but because they were still new films as well then, they weren't, I would argue, classic at the time. In the same way we can look back at 50 years, it's kind of thinking of like a franchise that's happening now like Marvel. We know it's going to be classic, but you probably get Marvel props that end up loose somewhere in the world today. And I think it's really fascinating when you see the history of cinema, how it changes and how Bond is always at the forefront of it.
I think it's also that our relationship with cinema as the grand public has changed. So now the idea, I mean, I think with Marvel, I mean, one of my most bizarre moments in my life is getting to hold Captain America's shield. I did hand Thor's hammer over to my colleague, Richard, who was obviously more worthy than I was. But you know those things are important now. And I think we know now that, you know, the DB5, or I'm sure there's somebody, in fact, I know Eon still owned the DBS from Casino Royale, but they, you know, Eon didn't even keep the car. That's the thing. Now, I just think that the studio would absolutely keep the car. They would be using it just the way they did in the kind of marketing activations. You know, they would be like, okay, we'll put it in a big corgi box and put it out at Bankside, you know, out at the Battersea Power Station. And I don't think that was just, I just don't think that's how the world worked in the 60s or the 70s. You know, people just thought it was, you know, over and done with. You know, I mean, and you have things like the whole kind of second life of the films being on TV doesn't even really kick in until the 70s. You know, so the way that we experience film and Bond is always at the forefront of that, as you say, has changed so much.
It is incredible, isn't it? And there's two little funny facts I found out in the hiatus that two of the Bonds have driven it. So George Lazenby drove the DB5 for some TV Return of the Man of Uncle in 1983. And then Roger had driven it in the Cannonball Run. And there's a little sort of spoof to it with the ejector seat.
Well, that's it. I mean, that shows you how closely associated Bond is with the DB5, that these Bonds who'd never drove it in a Bond film, it's still kind of like, oh, look, it's James Bond because he's in the DB5. How do you show that Roger Moore is really James Bond? Put him in a DB5. Same thing with George Lazenby, you know.
When it came back for the Pierce Brosnan era, you know, we've already said that, of course, it was slightly different. And there was a third DB5, I think, for some of the shots. But it actually got damaged, didn't it? On the sort of chasing.
There's a picture of that. That's quite.
Yeah, it's
nasty. Oh, yeah. You're looking. Oh. Yeah, crumpled wing.
Yeah.
I enjoy a spirited ride as much as the next girl, but. Who's that?
The next girl.
Yeah, and then you can see like the difference in the camera technology as well, because we've got pictures in the book, and it's quite a famous picture of that with all the kind of camera mount on the front of the car. So you realise that, you were talking about that, like, you know, how I can't remember whether it's 9 or 7 DB5s they have in For No Time to Die. And, you know, the way that you film has changed. The what you can do, and the fact that you might have one car set up to do one thing and another one to do another. And if you want to riddle it with holes, maybe you don't want to do that to your best car, you know. So it is a sign of how filmmaking has changed as well as films, you know. And there's just the scale of things. It's just beyond belief now.
I think it's clear as well that it's Bond's personal car. You know, it's not just some standard issue thing that he has. In Thunderball, I think, do we see it's outside the sort of health retreat place as well?
Yeah, he takes it to
yeah,
yeah,
and then,
and then there's the sequence with the bike as well. Yeah,
that's a brilliant sort of misdirection, isn't it? Because you think he's going to use all these gadgets on this car that's chasing, but then Fiona Volpe comes from nowhere and she's the one who uses these gadgets, which is brilliant. In GoldenEye and the two films on, of course, very briefly in Tomorrow Never Dies, you see it when he's brushing up on a little Danish at Oxford.
Yeah.
And then there's a deleted scene from World Is Not Enough. But it's his car, isn't it? It's the one he's driving.
I know, so, I kind of never know whether James Bond has any kind of personal life outside working from my It's like, you know, did he, you know, he, obviously he has access to enormous funds.
Yeah.
But I don't know that his salary is going to be that great.
I think it's Christopher Lee, maybe, in The Man with the Golden Gun, you know, that, you know, why don't you work for me? You can earn some real money here compared to what you're doing for the government. So you could be a hitman. And then, yeah, sort of Sean Bean is trying to make a load of money, isn't he? Basically far more than he did as an MI6 agent. So it is implied that whilst he has this high life with expensive suits, expensive cars and all this places he goes to, he's not actually earning anything like as much money as he could be doing, which is unusual.
Killing people. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the books, he is a man of independent means. He owns property in Jamaica, rather like Ian Fleming. Surprise, surprise. I mean, in the films, Daniel Craig films, he does seem to have a kind of a serious number of cars stashed away in lockups around the place. Yeah. That's it's like you're imagine right, there's another lockup somewhere with a Lotus in it.
Yeah. It did get quite a few cheers when he unveils the car from The Living Daylights in the.
Yeah.
It's almost like the same.
It's exactly
garage.
The same. It's in a different place, so it shouldn't be the same lockup. I don't know if they use the same tarpaulin. They might have done that. I mean, they definitely echo the shot deliberately.
Yeah.
Because again, you're set up to think there's going to be another DB5 under there, and it's like, oh no, he has other Aston Martins.
You both, of course, went to the premiere, so there was one of the DB5s on show, wasn't there? Do you know which one that was, Ben?
I don't actually. It was very, very crowded at the premiere, as you can imagine. So I'm in the fortunate position of having seen the DB5 quite a lot. So I was like, oh yeah, there's the DB5. But I didn't even check the number plate, actually.
They had, at the top of the stairs, I mean, there was two areas. So you had, I think, the official entry for like the guest, like Daniel Craig's. And I think they had a V8 there and a normal DB5.
Mm.
Then the top of the stairs,
well, certainly,
the damaged DB5 from the film as like a photo op for everyone.
Yeah, certainly on a Spectre they had the DB10. I remember the DB10 was just like, I mean, DB5 is a beautiful car, but it's one that we're kind of familiar with. Whereas the DB10 is like this kind of futuristic work of art. And, you know, it was, I remember being really struck by that. And then you did know there were only 10 of those. So, you know that you're looking at the screen used one. But yeah, I mean, I imagine it would be one of the Eon cars. So they have a couple now.
They had as well. This was a really weird side story. When the film finished, me and my friend that I went with, we ended up at the VIP exit. Not quite sure how still, but where like Rami Malek was, Hammond Zimmer and all that. And we turned a corner and there was the Aston Martin lorries. We said, oh, okay, they're putting the DB5s back in. But then they had the Goldfinger Rolls Royce. I was like, hold on, what's that doing here? Oh. And I think there was like other cars there that they just didn't get to put out. And I think they might have Cubby Broccoli's Rolls Royce as well from...
It turns up in a couple of films. It's in A View to a Kill.
So there was loads more hidden at the back of the event. Now, whether I don't know if there are other parts of a carpet, but it's amazing.
Well, I think they're all going back to Bewley. Yeah, there was the Bond in Motion exhibition. There was the original exhibition. You know, so they have been making much more use of the cars than they did in the past.
Because there's a new No Time to Die exhibition. I think the big one's gone to the States for a year, and I think they've opened up a smaller one in Bewley for No Time to Die. So, I mean, not that there's too many new ones in the film. I know they've got the Destroyer DB5, and I think they were talking about the... I don't know if there's an official term yet for the glider at the end. I don't know if that's got a formal Bond title yet, but...
Oh, I don't know.
It'd be interesting to see, because it's a shame they shut down Bond in Motion in London, because I really wanted to go. I didn't realize they'd shut it over the last few years. And it makes sense to ship it to America, I think. But I'd imagine maybe next year for the sixth shift, they'll probably maybe get it back in London or at Bewley for the anniversary month or something.
I'm sure they'll do something.
I'm sure Ben might know something, but he isn't allowed to say.
I'm certainly not allowed to say certain things. I was, funny enough, talking to him yesterday about what might be happening for the 60th, but it's all still to be finalized.
Of course. So, yeah, when you watch the premiere, Ben, just tell us what you thought of the film. I'm interested to get opinions. Yeah,
I love the film. I mean, I think the thing I loved about it was that from the word go, I thought this is a film about something. You know, I mean, you know, when you go and see a Bond film, that you're going to see phenomenal stunts. You know, it's going to look beautiful. I mean, particularly since Skyfall, when Roger Deakins came on board, that, you know, they really recognize the importance of making the films look stunning. So you kind of know it's going to have those production values, and you know, it's going to have amazing action sequences. You know, not all Bond films deliver to the same degree, I think, is that emotional connection. You know, and for me, you know, Casino Royale had done that, and Skyfall does that in spades, and this also delivered that. But you could kind of, I had that feeling from the beginning that this is going to add up to something. You know, there's going to, I mean, obviously didn't know how it was going to end because Leon had told me, but I felt absolutely engaged from the first moment, and that's always a really good sign for me.
What I want to add to that, I know that some people might want to know the ending before, but would you say it's a bit of a gift for this film more than any other that you didn't know the ending?
I would. I mean, I would say to anyone, I would say, go and read You Only Live Twice. Don't see it, read it. Because what amazes me about the Bond films is how they still manage to find bits from the books that haven't been used. Safin's Poison Gun is from the book You Only Live Twice. And in fact, the ending is pretty similar to the end of You Only Live Twice, which we all know had a sequel. Though I guess Bond films have kind of been doing it the wrong way around, where Skyfall, he comes back from the dead in Skyfall.
I think it's been amazing as well that people haven't spoiled it.
Yeah.
I've seen very little of that, thankfully, on social media.
Even now, I mean, I'm being cautious because I'm assuming everybody's seen the film now, but perhaps not. I mean,
Australians, they're in the Antipodeans won't have seen well. They probably will do by the time this is out. I think I heard somebody, I think it might have been Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode, comparing it to The Mousetrap. We do ask that you leave the theatre and do not reveal the secret of The Mousetrap, but it's almost become that. But there's loads of other sort of massive things that happen in the film.
There are. I mean, it's a film, and I don't assume that everybody's seen it. So, you know,
you don't have to say,
Ben. It's a film but I think it's a film that moves the franchise and moves Bond on. And it's 100% a film that does things that no other Bond film has ever done.
Yeah,
I'm quite similar with that. I think, I mean, on our video, we went 4 hours somehow still. We're on a Raid 007's length. But it was one of them to me where I think because so many things have been done, what can you do that's not already been done? And I know that they have to have that approach, I guess, for every film, for stunts, for whatnot. But I think the moment, I don't mind saying, you got the opening barrel where you get a zoom into the snow, like, okay, this isn't Bond. This is going to be someone different. And we've not had this in a very long time. And I think I'm a massive Cary Fukunaga fan, so I had a bit of bias heading into the film. But it's really interesting. And because I love my box office numbers, I get really nerdy with stuff like that. Every week, it's so exciting to look at those charts because the pandemic has essentially wiped out the box office. And it's UK box office-wise is just overtook Avengers Endgame, which I never saw coming in a million miles post-pandemic. And I know it's not done as it's still done well in America, but Sony got smart and released Venom the week before, and Venom's the one that's made most of its money in America. And it's really exciting to see the box office numbers. Yes, it's past 600 million at the time of recording. And I thought this would have hit 500 and be done, but this is still going. This is breaking records here. And as I said, we've still got some territories that don't have it. And even added to that, we're getting the Blu-ray before Christmas, which is insane to think. It's exciting because I'll be able to get it quickly, but it's amazing what, you know, we waited 2 years and then you're getting the film in a Blu-ray in the space of 3 months, which is remarkable.
Again, sign of the way the world has changed. You know, you'd be like, back and you saw Goldfinger, you'd be like, I hope they show this in the cinema again. You know,
yeah,
go and see the,
you wouldn't see it,
go and see the double bill with Thunderball. A year later.
I think whatever the box office, though, it will be the most talked about film of the year. And it will be a massive success, you know, going forward, and it will always be remembered as a massive Bond film.
I think
so. I don't think Eon have to worry about anything like that.
But. Oh no! I mean, I think creatively, it's a great success, and you can't ask for more than that. You know, I mean, Bond films, everyone's going to revisit every Bond film. So even if the cinemas are shut and no one's going, it's still a big deal, you know.
Yeah.
And people will still see it, and people will still be moved by it. And people, like you said, will talk about it, because it does also, I think, it really turns those Daniel Craig films into a single story, really, I think. It really sort of successfully delivers on that in a way that I think they were reaching for in Spectre but didn't quite deliver. So I think it's a really sort of satisfying conclusion to the Daniel Craig saga.
And it also gives a fresh slate, doesn't it, now, going forward? We can do pretty much whatever they
want. And a big challenge. Where do you go from here?
Of course.
I mean, you know, how do you top Goldfinger? Where do you go from No Time to Die? Big questions.
They'll do it. They've done it before. I'm sure they'll manage it. Just don't have to wait too long. That's the main worry.
Well, it's hard work. If I'd been involved in making one of these, I'd definitely want to lie down for a couple of years afterwards.
Yeah, well, we say, of course, you know, Daniel gets fed up with all the attention and everything sometimes because it's such a massive role to have on your shoulders. But Sean Connery, think of doing all those films every year, no breaks whatsoever, going to places like Japan and people mobbing you, and well, there's reporters come into his room at night and all sorts of stories like that. You can understand, can't you, why it got too much for him, certainly. I mean, we all say we'd love to be Bond, but you can't possibly know what it's like. Only six people have ever had that privilege, haven't they?
Yeah, very, very hard work, I tell you. Just from a distance, not that I really know, but just looking, you can see how much hard work it is. And I think that's only
become... on you, aren't they? You know, you're responsible at the end of the day.
But also, I mean, you can't eat properly for 9 months. You know, if you keep your body in that shape now. Yeah. You know, you can't have one drink too many in a restaurant, you know. Yeah, everybody looks at you and thinks you're James Bond. There must be people who want to hear you. You know, I mean, just, you know, no. I mean, hard work.
We'll leave it to the professional.
Even the actors that aren't Bond, like any young British actor does well in a drama with a bit of grit, and there's the article the next day, this is the new Bond, and suddenly that actor is getting shadowed 24/7, and I know the Marvel film's coming out, Eternals, and there's this amazing interview, Richard Madden on the red carpet, and... some randomer just says to him, you know, you've done The Bodyguard, are you playing James Bond? And his publicist just steps in and says he's not answering that question. And he kind of did this lovely smile and walked off. And, you know, the pressure anyone...
He's quite short, Richard Madden.
Yeah.
He's not a tall man.
He's... Well... I would love him. Not to get into that conversation, but I think with Eon, you know, I've not really... You know, I was 10 when Casino came out. I remember hearing about Craig, but this will be the first time I get to witness... the whole process of a new Bond, and whatever happens next, they have incredibly tough boots to fill. Yeah. But it's just amazing seeing, you know, some of the names that come and go with it. And I think Henry Golding's one, and Henry Golding Bond, and then he did a film that wasn't well received, and that's all gone zip quiet. And it's a fascinating process. It must be unbearable for Eon as well, who are actually trying to do their job amongst doing this, to find someone. But
I think they just don't pay too much attention to it.
No.
You know, I mean, I'm sure they have some ideas, but it won't just be like, oh yeah. You know, I think the only time that they have known 100% who they wanted was with Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah.
You know, with Pierce Brosnan, he was cast, and then Timothy Dalton came, you know, because of all the whole Remington Steele nonsense. But every other time they're like, no, we know what we want to do. We know what kind of actor we want. But we're just going to find the best actor we possibly can. And I think, Daniel Craig just took that to the next level for me.
They've learned, though, from Casino Royale as well, that despite everybody having a go at him before they'd even seen him in a film, just wait until you've seen the film before you judge it. So whoever is cast...
Nobody has any doubts about Daniel Craig now, you know.
No, well, that's what I mean. You know, you've got to wait until... Well, no, you don't even have to wait to see his legacy. You just needed to wait until you'd seen him on screen, didn't you?
Yeah.
So whoever is cast, whatever bad press they get will go away, provided they're right.
You know what? I mean, there are people who will always say how much they hate something before they know anything about it.
Yeah.
I think Michael Keaton as Batman's a famous one, and that's heading back to the
80s. Yeah.
You know, I think every time it happens, there's somebody somewhere that dislikes it that's got a loud opinion, and we'll get it for the next one, whoever it is. Someone somewhere will moan. But I think history's repeated itself in more than just Bond. You know, I think Heath Ledger's Joker is another perfect example of some people believing they can cast things better than those that do it for a living. So, yeah, it's going to be an experience, but I'm excited. But at the same time, I'm kind of good because, you know, growing up with Craig's Bond for me is a side piece. You know, I was a very sort of important part of my life studying the films and whatnot as well. It's kind of sad to see him go. Like, he's been this peripheral figure for 15 years, and I love him as an actor. And I think, don't want to sit there and say he's got happiness, but he's doing Macbeth on stage next year already, and he's got Knives Out stuff. So it's really interesting to see what he's going to now be able to do with a closed door on the franchise.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, he's Daniel's a very versatile and very powerful actor, and I think he will have he'll do great work whatever happens. I think, you know, but once you've been James Bond, you're always James Bond.
Yeah. Before we go, Ben, I just wanted to just ask, what are your projects in the fire? You've got a couple of these more James Bond books, as well as the DB5 one out.
Yes, we've got the film guide, which tells you what happens in No Time to Die.
It does tell you.
It does tell you. That's why it's not out yet.
Wow.
So the film guide is a kind of encyclopedia, kind of scrapbook full of beautiful pictures. It covers all 25 Bond films and, you know, allows you to remember which film Odd Job was in, or which film Jaws was in, all that kind of stuff, or Gabinda. Obscure. And it's a beautiful book again. Lots of fantastic pictures in, and I think, you know, it's a perfect book for the 60th anniversary next year. So they're out. As I say, the DB5 book, it's probably the thing I'm proudest of having been involved with. I mean, I it's not for me to say, but I am going to say I think it's the best Bond book that has ever been published.
Brilliant.
I
wouldn't disagree with you. It is wonderful. And I don't know an awful lot about cars, and I found it fascinating just to learn how these things are done and all the stuff that is done to bring this to the screen. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's got beautiful pictures in it. It's a coffee table. Yeah. I mean, it does have lots of very interesting words in it, but it's also an incredibly beautiful book. And I, you know, there are times when you work on something and it just comes out better than you ever imagined. And this is, for me, this is one of those times. You know, when we first sat down and tried to plan this book, and we're like, okay, we'll put this and we'll put that in. And then you get to the end and you look at it and you go, wow, we made this. So I'm amazed, and, you know, intensely proud of it. And I just really hope that people like it. You know, I mean, it's well, that's the thing about anything creative. You make it and then you put it out there and you hope people like it.
We'll be championing it then, don't worry. But tell us.
Thank you.
Just tell us how you can buy it, actually.
From bookstores, bookshops everywhere, I hope. Yeah, I mean, it's Amazon are discounting it, I think, at the moment. Not massively like some of our books, but it's quite healthily. You can always buy it from us, so we're shop.eaglemoss.com. But yeah, I mean, I as I say, I think it's a fantastic subject, and I think the book turned out better than we could ever have imagined. So, you know, I really want people to own it and enjoy it, and not just so that it makes money so we can make something else.
But it is a hardback book, everybody. It's not one of these, wait for the paperback. No, it's a proper picture book that's massive and will be something that you'll show to your children and your grandchildren, I think.
I think it's the best possible Christmas present you could buy anyone. That's what I'm going to say.
I'll leave that bit in. Don't worry about it.
I hope that comes. I hope this podcast comes out before Christmas. I'll wait another 10 months before I buy it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you, Ben, so much for joining us tonight. It's been a pleasure. We always love talking James Bond, and we haven't really dwelt much on the DB5, but I think we all love it, and we can't wait to see where Aston Martin and Eon and your publishing company go in the future. I think it's going to be a fascinating few years for the James Bond franchise.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I've just realised something, actually. Piece of trivia. The DB5 has now been in more Bond films than any Bond, any particular Bond actor.
Right, yeah. Yes, it has, hasn't it? Because Roger did 7.
Yeah.
So it's been in... It has been an 8 then, yeah?
Well, yeah.
If you include the... yeah, well, I'm including that. Because Roger didn't make a cameo in another Bond film, so it's definitely done more than.
Yeah, so it's every bit as much the star of the films as any Bond actor.
The car's the star. Very good. Thank you, Ben, for joining us. Thank you, George, as well. We've loved having you, and we look forward to chatting more James Bond very soon. So good evening, gents. Good night.
Good night. Really the worst.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.